listeners to Sounding Out's podcast series, an oral chronicle of sound and culture. Sounding Out remixes the everyday with theory, insight, and practice. To learn more, please visit us on the web at www.soundstudiesblog.com. Until then, stay tuned for today's episode. Hi, this is Aaron from Sounding Out, and I'm here today with Jonathan Stern, who is a professor of communication studies at McGill University. Hello, Jonathan.
Hello, Aaron. I really enjoy Sounding Out. It's a wonderful sort of interdisciplinary clearinghouse for sound studies scholarship. It seems to remain committed to an interdisciplinary sense of what sound studies is and should be, especially through the reporting on different conferences, brings in lots of different perspectives, has many junior scholars and grad students appearing in it. I think it's a great example of the promise of, really the promise of the digital humanities, because in this case, rather than going out and getting a mega grant for super expensive tools, people who are interested, like you, just said, we're going to create a forum, we're going to create a space, we're going to make it happen, and we're going to do it, and then everybody else showed up. So, it's probably my favorite institutionalization of sound studies that exists.
Thanks. we're going to do an interview today. Jonathan is a really, really important figure in the field of sound studies, and I've just got a few questions for this this interview. So tell me about yourself. You used to be a musician?
Yeah, well, I mean, I still am. I'm just a hack, right? I'm not I don't make my living nobody pays me to do it. But I do still play music. I've been a bass guitarist since I was 14. I started on upright when I was 10. Although that sort of went by the wayside when the school bass was no longer free or $10 a year or whatever my parents paid. I played in bands all through college and grad school, and a little bit as a professor, not quite as much. I still play music with people as bassists. I also do, I've been doing more and more electronic stuff, probably because I've run into so many electronic musicians through my work as a scholar. It's really tuned me into that kind of music, although even as a kid I knew about Tangerine Dream and that kind of stuff, so I was aware of some kinds of, and Brian Eno, some kinds of electronic music. But so I've been doing more and more of that stuff, and actually had my first gig as an electronic musician in a couple weeks, just for 7 minutes, but still. So.
Oh, you have it in a couple weeks.
Yeah.
What kind of stuff are you gonna do?
I put out a record myself on Bandcamp, and so I'm gonna do a piece from that. It's for this thing at Tufts. I had to write a program note. It's totally not the kind of music that you write a program note for, but I'm completely nervous about it. I'm sure something's gonna go horribly wrong, and you know, but whatever. If you don't try new things, what's the point?
Agreed. Well, I'll be sure to add the Bandcamp link to the actual blog there so the listeners can check it out. Favorite band that you're in, one musician to another.
Favorite band that I was in? Well, I don't know. That's going to piss off all my other bands.
Classic prisoner's dilemma.
Yes, classic prisoner's dilemma. I'm going to go with Low Boy, which is the last sort of long-term band project I was in Pittsburgh, with a guy named Mike Whitmore, who now runs the Folger Shakespeare Library. And Mike and I, we had an idea that it would be a two-bass cabaret act, and it didn't really go cabaret. It went really ponderous post-rock, but it was a lot of fun, and in the end, I was quite pleased with sort of the sounds of the records we did together. So,
cool. All right, so I'd love to talk to you about the bands that you've been in all day.
It's totally not important, and no one knows about them, and but in the grand scheme of things, they're probably not even that good.
They will. We're gonna list whatever we can on the write-up, so we'll make sure they're there. Learn about Jonathan Stern's second self. All right, so in your book, MP3, my favorite chapter was the chapter about the cat and the telephone. So tell me about how you came to this, the research of that chapter. Fill the listeners in a little about what the chapter is about, and I guess like some thoughts you have.
Okay, so I mean, let me tell you what the chapter does first, then we'll talk about why I wrote the chapter that way and that sort of stuff. So the chapter tells the intertwined histories of psychoacoustics and information theory, basically through cats. And the reason that I want to tell these histories is that if you look at the existing literature, especially in science and technology studies, there's a lot of work that talks about information theory emerging after World War II, along with cybernetics, in response to things that, you know, particular problems like how do you shoot down an airplane and things like that were important questions to the U.S. military in World War II. And of course, it's also the information theory is also the basis of a lot of the operations inside the computers we use today. But in fact, if you read Claude Shannon's Mathematical Theory of Communication, footnotes 1 and 2 are two articles published in the 1920s that represented work going on at Bell Labs. And so I went back and read those articles. I was amazed at, and Shannon's very, very like gives credit freely to these people, but we just sort of forget because we're not in that discourse. And humanists have done a good job of sort of resuscitating Claude Shannon. He shows up in lots of science and technology studies stuff. He shows up in Catherine Hales. He shows up in lots of different literature, but they don't necessarily go back and then read his sources. And so it turns out a lot of the ideas in Shannon were actually developments out of research in how to make the telephone better, how to make the telegraph better. And by better, I don't mean more awesome, but better from the perspective of the phone company, more efficient, more effective. And this was also a sort of response to German media theory, which sees technical media, to use Kittler's term, as a kind of outgrowth of the military, right? So he has if you go on Google Books, do a search through gramophone, film, typewriter, and you look for the phrase "abuse of army equipment," it comes up a few times, right? And it's a great joke. I would make it multiple times too if I thought it up, right? Every entertainment technology is an abuse of army equipment. That's a good one, Friedrich. But I think that in focusing on the military, and that's also true in Peter Galison's famous cybernetics essay and in several other places, the military focus is really strong. So I don't want to say the military is not important. I just want to say that capitalism, and especially communications capitalism, was also a really important part of the development of information theory. So that's sort of where I went there. Now, of course, it's not just communications capitalism, but telephonic capitalism, right? It is the business of sound, or one business of sound. In the scholarship, and this is just an accident of the disciplines, right? We think of radio history as at least partially an aesthetic history. Film sound is partially an aesthetic history. But until very recently, you wouldn't find a lot of humanists or interpretive social science people writing at great length about the telephone as an aesthetic medium. And maybe as telephones themselves, especially landlines, are sort of in decline, at least in the rich countries where most sound studies is done, maybe it's just that it's an Owl of Minerva thing, where now we can sort of see the telephone as a specific aesthetic mode of experience as well, right? So maybe it's not us being particularly clever, but having something revealed to us. So anyway, that's what I was trying to do in that chapter. Now, why cats? Well, first of all, someone told me about the Weber-Bray experiment, and I don't actually remember who. It could have been my colleague Cornelius Bork, because I know he knew about it before me. Could have been Mara Mills, because I bet she knew about it before me. Could have been somebody else too, but I don't really remember who told me about it. But when they did, of course, I immediately was attracted to it. You know, there's Benjamin's line, there is no document of civilization, which is also not a document of barbarism. This seems like that. Also, you know, although MP3 is a much less Foucauldian book than The Audible Past in a lot of ways, you know, opening a chapter or a book with something gruesome is, of course, you know, in the honorable legacy of Discipline and Punish. And as a lover of cats, ironically, this, you know, seemed like a good thing to do. My cats, as I was writing the chapter, would sometimes sit on the desk and sort of look at me disapprovingly. But they seemed to have forgave me for it each night when I would feed them.
Yeah.
So the cat thing, it started with just the cat telephone, and then I found all this other cat stuff in cybernetics and information theory, and people started giving me cat things. Doug Kahn turned me on to Operation Acoustic Kitty, which got a lot of news coverage on September 10th, 2001, and then it was forgotten about. The Napster cat, right? That was like shooting fish in a barrel, right? It was so obvious and a perfect place to end. And so, you know, the cat thing really became a kind of literary conceit. I mean, I wouldn't defend it as like a demanding analytical choice, other than the fact that the cat telephone, I think, really does show the way in which people were trying to literalize the brain as a sonic information processor, which is sort of what I'm trying to do with it. So that part of it I would defend on scholarly grounds. The sort of sticking with cats to tell the rest of the history is just a fun way to do it. I think that cats have played a really important role in the history of psychoacoustics, in part because their auditory systems are similar enough to humans to study, but cats are much cheaper in terms of animal experimentation than monkeys. So having it as a kind of totem of the MP3 actually works really well. Because many cats have suffered for our audio technologies. And, I mean, there was this other aspect to it, which was just the whole time I was writing the chapter, I was thinking, I can't believe no one's going to stop me from doing this. Right? So it's like some sort of vestigial, like, grad school acting out thing. But, I really enjoyed writing that chapter, and I think that it tells the story in an interesting way, and it tries to tell a different story than the one that's usually told about information theory and cybernetics and psychoacoustics.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting that you say that, like, about the cat, right? Like, it's appearing again and again in the discourse of, you know, audio acoustics, but it's also this thing that appears again and again on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Just a mimetic creature.
Oh yeah, totally. And I mean, it's also of that moment, right? The and even before, right? I quote Darton, there's a certain je ne sais quoi about cats from the Great Cat Massacre. Right? So it's got this history, it's got this long history even before cats were sort of seen as meme-worthy. They played other roles in 18th century French. Well, I don't know if that was 18th century. I should say, even though I'm a historian, when I'm on my feet, I'm not great with names and dates. I'm really glad I can look stuff up. So
that's a perfect. So
you should like look that up if you really want to know when that happened.
That's a perfect segue to the next question. I wanted to ask you a little about your research methods as a historian, because you're a little unorthodox, right? Most historians can find themselves to a period. And I want to know about the deliberation behind that decision to move in centuries.
Well, okay. So first of all, by many measures, I'm not a proper historian. I'm not employed in a history department. I'm employed in a mixed department, which has history in its name, art history and communication studies. But by history department measures, I am in some ways not a proper historian. My interest in history actually came out of engagements with theory, right? As a sort of, I'm not a strong like methodologist. I sort of think you use the method that answers the questions the way you want the questions composed and that gets you where you want to go. So for instance, in the audible past, everybody I was writing about, more or less until the very end, everybody I was writing about was dead. So it's going to be documentary history. I mean, I could have done folklore or something like that. Maybe I could have done more with the recordings I listened to, although I couldn't really figure that out at the time. Whereas with this book, I was reading all this stuff by engineers, and I realized that there is all this tacit knowledge. And so then I started talking to living engineers. And that led to oral history, which has now led me to do participant observation in some of my newer work. But So my original training is cultural studies, so methodologically I'm an opportunist. And I'm not slavishly devoted to one or another, but I do take it seriously. I'm more interested in vigor than rigor, though. Like, we're not, the kinds of work I do is not something where you're operationalizing a variable in a laboratory that can then be reproduced by independent observation, although I like to get my facts straight. I still haven't answered your time question. So, I mean, the simple answer is that the people who I'm inspired by most, who write about the past, write in long swaths of time. And I'll name, well, with some exceptions. I'll give you some exceptions. And now that I think about it, it is interestingly gendered, right? So you have Marx. He wrote about, the so-called primitive accumulation, part 8 of Capital, volume 1. Brilliant piece of sort of reconstructivist historiography. Really long period of time. Raymond Williams, Long Revolution. Really long period of time. Foucault. Not narrative history, genealogy, or archaeology, depending on the period, at least the periods of Foucault that I engage with in particular, also deals with sort of these long swaths of time. Now, you get into all sorts of trouble, right? If your goal for writing history is, say, to recover the experience or the flavor of what it was like to be in a place at a particular time, the more you think of history as a kind of documentary ethnography, the harder it is to do that sort of long-term history. But there are other ways of writing history, and the other set of influences are people like Lynn Spiegel, who understand historical materials as themselves representations. Make Room for TV was a hugely formative book for me because in the very body of her text, I mean, this is something any historian who's any good would say. If you ask them, yes, of course the text is a representation, but then that would be sort of repressed in the narrative that they give, right? You would make claims to the real. And in that early book, she has a very good way of moving between sort of the acts of interpretation of historical document and actually treating them as representations on the surface of the text. Now, of course, that's a much shorter term book, but it was also because the object demanded it, which was the emergence of television in the late 50s and early 60s in American culture, and the really central role of both ideas about women and women's experiences in the construction of TV. With the MP3 book, I thought I was writing a short second book. That was the goal. Clearly, I failed. I was going to write like a short sort of like, hey, here's a primer on the MP3. And it was going to start with the invention of the MP3. The problem was, when I got into it, I realized that the stories that engineers were telling me reframed the whole history of communication in the 20th century. In other words, they knew things that people in the humanities, in the social sciences and sound studies and media studies, they just weren't talking about. And it's basically what I call in the book, the general history of compression. It took me a long time to get to that, term. But for me anyway, it was really important to go back and retell all these dimensions of communication history, of which the MP3 is a kind of almost banal artifact, right? If you want to understand it, you have to understand the history of psychoacoustics. And that was the thing that got me interested in the first place. What's this subject that's coded in to audio and into every MP3 that's sort of spit out by an encoder? If you want to understand sort of the way engineers are thinking about signal efficiency and infrastructure, that's a long question. And it's not a connection I had to work very hard to make when I was interviewing J.J. Johnston, and I asked him, like, where did you get your psychoacoustics tables from? Where do you get your research methods from? He walks me downstairs. He pulls Harvey Fletcher's Speech and Hearing off the shelf. And of course, for those of you that haven't read the book, Fletcher's Speech and Hearing was written on, based on work done in the 1920s at Bell Labs. So the circle was closed quite easily for me by my own research subjects. And so, I mean, there are costs to doing it that way, right? The actual story of the MP3 is not as long as the whole book, right? There's all this other stuff that you sort of got to know, but it's a good story.
Right.
And I think it works as a story. It took me a long time to actually even get to the point of telling the things in order. That's another reason why I'm not a proper historian, right? Like the resistance to chronological sequence. And finally, I gave into it because it was way easier to give a good story that made sense and that would invite readers in rather than push them away. At least that's the hope.
So just a follow up. As someone who is a little similar with broader swaths of history, sometimes I feel lost. So do you feel lost ever when you're going through this and you're like,
wow, oh my God, yes. So when I was writing my dissertation, there were scanners, but grad students didn't have them. So I would go to the archives and I would like Xerox things, right? And I would have these stacks and stacks of papers and like file drawers full of stuff. For every chapter of my dissertation, I reorganized all of my files because I had no idea what I was doing. And I mean, the other thing for me, because I work with technical materials, I'm always working at the very limits of my own education and capabilities. And so I'm constantly talking to people in engineering saying, wait, so if I say it this way, does that make sense? Is that right? And I mean, I'm not afraid of being wrong because, you know, people are wrong all the time. I think that there's an overinvestment in our field sometimes of not taking chances, and then, you know, you can say, well, that didn't work. Okay, whatever. I'm not afraid of being wrong, but I want to, it matters to me a lot as somebody who came up during the Sokol affair and things like that to try to get the engineering right, because there are people I can ask. It's not like I can't. Mm-hmm. Well, here I can walk across the hall, but we're doing this interview at Microsoft Research. But normally, like, I'd have to, you know, send somebody an email or pick up the phone or walk across campus. But I could do that. And there are lots of people who are willing to help me out and make sure I get my stuff straight. And then I also get to have one of those wonderful interdisciplinary conversations where you're talking to somebody in a completely different field who's interested in some of the same stuff as you.
Great.
So,
well, this is another great segue then, right? Like, so you're bringing in a lot of theory, right, that does challenge the norm, right? You're looking at a lot of critical theory. And some of this has fallen out of fashion.
Uh-huh.
So tell me about that. How can you still use some theory that's a little...
Well, so I should ask you what theory you think I use that's fallen out of fashion. That would be a fairer way to pose the question, and then I can answer it.
So I was thinking about the Jacques Attali's stuff on noise. That's uh-huh. I guess the thing, you know, like we had a conversation the other day as a group, and you yourself admitted that, like, you know, there's a lot of things in Attali's noise you no longer want to agree with, but there's some pruning, charitable pruning that does occur as you...
Well, sure. I mean, so for me, theory is not a template, right? I think, and this might be a particularly bad habit in communication studies. I don't really know. But since that's, you know, the field in which I have my PhD, I know in particular, this sort of, I call it finding panopticons, where you're sort of like do work that's like field work for the theorist, and you're like, hey, look, this thing conforms to what this person said.
Yeah.
So I don't want to do that. For me, theory, the reason theory books are great when they're great, I mean, they often fail. And even sometimes the failure is spectacular and wonderful. But a great theory book gives you a way of describing the world and asking questions that you wouldn't have been able to do before. The theory book is not great because it gives you a vocabulary that you can just staple to whatever object you find out there in the world. So for me, theory is inspirational literature. So you take someone like Attali, Sure. He gets a lot wrong, right? This whole, superstructure anticipating the base thing only works if you're only looking at France and you're not looking at, say, industrialization across Europe. A lot of what he says about improvised jazz and composition is problematic. A lot of what he says about repetition and mass culture is problematic. And yet he asks some really great questions. And to my undergraduate mind, the book was so delirious and wonderfully inspiring because of that delirious prose. So I'm incredibly grateful to him for that. Even if, on many particular points, I would say, forget it. Now, do I always teach Atali? Well, I did put him in the sound studies reader. I teach him sometimes when I'm teaching sound. I don't always. It depends on what the course is about and what you're trying to do. So, for instance, in the fall when I'm doing a class, I won't teach him. But it's useful to me, and I would recommend him to certain people, but not to everyone all the time. I'm not a big canons person. Everybody should read this one thing. So... Christopher Smalls, the other person I mentioned in that conversation, everything he says about Africa in music society education is kind of cringy. It's of a moment, and he's trying to do something else, and he's stretching to and working at the limits of his knowledge. But that book, with its sort of argument, Ivan Illich-like argument about music and technology and society, is really quite exciting and inspiring as well, to say, by looking at music, you can actually ask these huge questions.
Right.
So for me, theory, my graduate advisor, Larry Grossberg, always used to say theory is cheap, it's politics that are hard. Theory is more expensive now than it was then, if you look at the price of books. But it's definitely something I'm not slavishly devoted to a theory or a position. I'm not really interested in defending a position or proving why so-and-so is right. I'm interested in dealing with big questions, and I think theory is really good for that and really good for inspiring you to do the same.
Okay, so moving on that, right? So let's think through some Marxist dialectics here, right? So why does sound studies happen at this particular historical moment?
I still don't think I understand Marxist dialectics, but that's another discussion. So why does sound studies happen at this moment? Okay, well, there's the sociology of knowledge answer, which is a pretty good one, which is there were other moments of big interdisciplinary ferment around sound, but they coalesce differently, right? So if you look at an earlier generation, you could talk about acoustic ecology, for instance, and the Murray Schafer crowd as being a kind of, some people see it as a part of sound studies, some people see sound studies as outgrowth of it. They're certainly intellectually related, and now they're all mixed up because there are lots of people that sort of travel in both or engage with both or whatever. And that moment was tied to the media changes people were experiencing in the 60s. It was tied to sort of political climate around a kind of environmentalism, anti-urbanism, and pastoralism that you saw in the United States and Canada at the time, especially. And it was tied to the sort of configuration of the disciplines in 15, 20 years after World War II. So why do sound studies emerge in the early aughts? The difference between acoustic ecology and sound studies is generational, right? So my generation's in grad school in the 1990s, people like me, Emily Thompson, we have experience with something sonic. In my case, I was a musician. She had some radio experience. And there's all this visual culture stuff going on, this wonderful interdisciplinary ferment around visual culture. And it was really hot then. And I'm not saying it's not a thing now, but it was, it was going, it was definitely going on then, and it was definitely a thing. And we all had different reactions to it. I wrote this undergrad thesis on Muzak in the Mall of America, and I went to do the lit review for chapter one, which is going to be on sound and modernity. I just assumed, we just happened to read visuality and modernity in our classes, and of course there'd be this big literature on sound, and there wasn't. And so that turned into a really good dissertation idea. I mean, there was more there than I could find at the time with my undergraduate research and reading skills and a much less digitally integrated corpus of scholarship. But there certainly wasn't that much. You know, there was like Doug Kahn, Wireless Imaginations, and that sort of thing. And then my professors were also really engaged with the new musicology, bringing cultural theory like feminism to musicology, right? Susan McClary's book came out in 1991. And so that was really an exciting moment. I was at the University of Minnesota and the humanities program was converting itself to this cultural studies program. And so it was this exciting moment. And there were a lot of people doing things at sort of the edge of cultural theory and musicology and music, often outside of music departments. And so one thing led to another. The first time I heard the term sound studies was actually, I want to say it was Doug Gomery, but it could have been one of the other film sound people, could have been Rick Altman. I don't know where I first encountered it, but it was in that coinage comes from that group. And of course they also were having the exact same reaction, right? Visual culture, film is a visual medium. Wait, no, it's not. It's not a visual medium, unless, you know, you watch silent movies in silence, which most people don't. So I think it was a reaction to I think at least for me and for a lot of the people I know, it was a reaction to both ideas about visual culture and the sort of bad ideas about sound that got smuggled in with it, like the audiovisual litany, which was me trying to name a tendency at the beginning of the audible past that maybe this isn't the way forward for thinking about sound, right? That maybe there's something other to sound than thinking about it as this archaic mode of social organization, or the flip side, which is a sort of utopian moment in secondary orality or something like that, where we're all gonna, you know, sort of find God through electronics.
Great answer.
Thank you.
So I wanted to ask a question because you brought up the early soundscapes, sort of Toronto school crew. So what does our thinking of soundscapes, of why soundscapes are valuable, have to do with their mediation through technology? How does technology change that?
Well, there's the Murray Schafer argument, right, which is a tragic narrative, or a Jeremiad, right, that we used to have these sort of hi-fi soundscapes and that, you know, cities and technology have produced these lo-fi soundscapes where signals interfere with one another. I don't like that so much.
I can imagine.
I mean, I really struggle with the term soundscape itself, as it's obviously really inspiring to a lot of people. And so in that sense, it's a great term and it sounds like what it means. But of course, that means it's susceptible to all the critiques of landscape, right? If it is the sonic equivalent of soundscape, then everything political that any art historian has ever said about landscape can be said about soundscape. Now, that said, if you want to talk about sort of technologization and sonic space, there's a lot that's been going on and there's a lot that's super interesting, right? So how do you theorize ambience in urban spaces? You look at the work of radio historians Alex Russo, David Goodman, who've done this great stuff on the prevalence of distracted listening, especially in sort of urban radio environments. Replacing this older theory that everybody was, you know, always paying close attention to the radios they were listening to. That's super exciting to me. My student and sounding out contributor Lillian Radovic has done some wonderful work about the politics of noise in New York City, both in terms of its relationship to zoning law and the use of zoning law to maintain race and class distinctions, but then also in terms of curbing public speech and public protest. And so I think in the end, her dissertation is going to show there's a much more radical and politicized explanation for the so-called bowling alone effect, the retreat from public discourse, than in the United States, at least in places like New York. than has been usually told, and that is that the authorities basically tried to stop people from having any kind of loud protests in public and actively worked against amplified speech, which restricted the size of assemblies. So there's stuff like that. And then the one place where I am completely in agreement with Schaefer, and Barry Truax taught me this, so I have to say this, which is that Schaefer represents only one position among the acoustic ecology people. It's just his is the one that travels the most and he gets cited the most. And I think they could do more to critique him too. So I'm talking about Schaefer specifically, but the one place where I really do agree with him is about the need for acoustic design, right? You can get certified as an architect and build homes and basically know nothing about sound or know very little about it. And if you do know something about it, you know it, you're trained to think about it as an afterthought, because what you really want to do is produce these sort of nice visual lines and things like that. And this comes up over and over again. So Bob Fink, who's a music professor at UCLA, who was telling me he's doing work on Disney Hall. So he was telling me, you know, Frank Gehry said that he designed the inside exactly the way he wanted it to be. But Bob actually listened to the meetings where this happened, and the acoustic architects were like, no, you can't do that because the room's going to sound like crap. So because it was an orchestra hall, right, there was this sort of great attention to acoustics. But that level of attention without that level of expense could perhaps proportionately be used in many other spaces to great benefit for many people for many reasons. And those spaces, I always think, you know, they sit empty so much of the time. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have a wider range of musics and sonic art experiences in those, like, absolutely beautiful sonic spaces that people could go and experience? And the MUTEC Festival in Montreal has done, did some really good stuff with that last year, but much more can be done.
Cool. All right, thanks, Jonathan. I've got one more question, and we are good. And that's, what's the one question you hate getting asked in interviews?
I actually don't know, because there isn't anything I'm really sick of. I'm pretty patient with it. I was once at a talk after my first book where a professor, you know, and it's not like everybody who shows up to my talk should have read my work beforehand. Professor of political science raises his hand and says, that was very interesting. That was early in the MP3 where he said, you know, it'd be really great if somebody would write a history of the idea of sound fidelity. And I said, you know, that's a really good idea. Yeah, I wish I had a cleverer answer. All right. Well, thanks for the interview.
No, thank you. It was a pleasure. This was excellent.